This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 40. And it's a good time to be turning to the response of the existing financial services institutions to the fintech revolution. I couldn't think of anyone better to discuss this with than Anna Herrera, who is perhaps the only full-time journalist working on fintech in London. She's been responsible for the significant increase in the Financial News' fintech coverage. The Financial News, I recall, many decades ago, when I got the first edition of what was then called the London Financial News, which is now owned by the Dow Jones Group. She has spearheaded the launch of the quarterly fintech-focused publication Fintech News. Specific areas of focus within fintech include alternative finance, blockchain, big data, robot advisory, cybersecurity, trading platforms, and digital payment systems. The Financial News also runs the odd in-depth conference on fintech, which, whilst coming from the suit end of the suit-to-t-shirt spectrum, offers some of the most hardcore content in a fintech scene which is slowly recovering from an excess of fluffy bunny hype. There's none of that from Anna, nor any mindless reformatting of PR releases that so often passes for journalism in many daily newspapers today, especially in the tech sector. Most articles on Apple's products might have well been written by Apple's PR department, it seems to me. Anna is well known on both the fintech and the old FS sides of the current divide, and always talks from the perspective of speaking to the miners at the coalface rather than the warmth of the press office. How banks respond to fintech is a key topic as to how they perform in the future. Ignore it at your peril, but also perhaps panic at your peril. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Anna. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mike. And thanks for the flattering introduction. Really glad to be here. It's been an interesting topic I've been following for the past few years, so I'm really keen to discuss it.
Well, as we'll hear in a few minutes, you were one of the crazy people to get into something when it wasn't obviously a good thing. It's now becoming more and more of a thing that you can't ignore. So we'll hear that story later. But going back to some of your first efforts in writing, I noticed on LinkedIn that you're the author of a book about Brazilian street children, which sounds fascinating. How did that project come about and how did it change your outlook on life?
So growing up, I spent lots of time with my family in Brazil. And during the summer, my parents used to volunteer for an NGO that helped street children in Brazil. So the book is about stories of the children that I met when I was there. And it was initially a project I wrote when I was at Harvard for one of my classes, and then I turned it into a book, I expanded it. I guess now it seems like I cover a completely different topic, but that's just what happened, I guess, life happened.
So, I mean, there must be many things that stick in your mind from having had that experience compared to, you know, the glass and steel buildings of London and all these sort of abstractions of finance, in some ways a kind of sort of more real kind of thing. But what kind of sticks in your heart most about it?
I mean, it's really hard to say, I guess, because I was so little the first time I went. I was 13. But I guess overall, it makes you more compassionate, especially if you come from, I guess, the first world and you're somewhat a privileged first world child. To be spending your summers in an orphanage is a bit different than maybe going to the beach where you would be going with your other friends. So I think it just opens your eyes to the fact that most of the people in the world don't have anything or have very little. And you just put things into perspective, I guess.
Yes, that's true. When I arrived, I was whinging to you about some of my private annoyances at the moment. And for some reason, the human brain isn't very well wired for being grateful for the million things that we have in every day to be pleased about. Just simply fresh air and water and things like that are really important. And as you say, a lot of people don't have that. So we've mentioned Brazil, and you've got a very interesting story or journey, which is that you started at school in Italy. You went to university in Italy where you studied law. Then you went and did a master's in New York on journalism, and you spent the time in Brazil, as we say. So with all of that background, how on earth did you end up being a journalist in rainy London?
For the weather, actually.
You came for the weather. I want to leave because of the weather.
I was told that it was great. No, so I'm Italian, which might start becoming apparent from my accent, but I went to an American school growing up, so I always spoke English, and then I decided to study in Italy. I don't know why.
I didn't know they spoke English in America. I thought they spoke American these days, actually. And actually, when I first met you, before I knew, I thought you were American rather than Italian.
So I don't know why. My first teacher when I was 3 was Irish, so I really don't know where my accent comes from. But anyways, I studied law in Italy, and then I really didn't want to be a lawyer from the beginning, which is a bit odd. that I studied law for 6 years. Then I did my master's in New York, and then I did an internship in Brazil. And when that was over, I had little time on my visa left in the US, and I looked for jobs everywhere, and I found a job at FN. So I moved to London, which I really like. So I'm glad.
I think that's one of the things about London, and one of the reasons why property prices are so out of control.
It's my fault.
Yeah, it's all your fault. Exactly. That's right. It's all these foreigners coming over here.
Journalists.
It's all these journalists. Prices, yeah. It's all these fintech journalists flooding into London. Notwithstanding the disadvantages of London, which aren't significant, it still is such a sort of huge centre for all kinds of people from all kinds of culture, which is what makes it very interesting. And certainly, I mean, it's the usual case that has been not so obvious to foreigners, perhaps, that haven't come to England, but London is London, and then England is England. You know, it always surprises me if you go not very far outside the M25, you can't get a decent cup of coffee, for example. You know, the whole of England, you almost can't get a cup of coffee, generalising about other centres. But London is still, for some reason, this kind of melting pot, and certainly in terms of financial services, it's one of the things that's not often focused on. But London is heavily reliant on the influx of people with initiative and ideas from the rest of the world to help foment and cultivate all sorts of revolutions in thought and ideas like that. And I think that's a great advantage that the UK has these days, funnily enough, compared to America, given that historically America was always seen and kind of grew up as being very open to foreigners coming there with their new ideas, and it's all rather flipped over. So you started off by being a journalist, and when were you first aware of the word fintech then, which obviously became something bigger and bigger in your life?
So, centre of my life now.
Absolutely, there's nothing more interesting than fintech, I was fine.
So, when I joined the FEN in 2012, I was an online reporter, which means that essentially that I would cover anything. I didn't have a beat like you would normally have. So I would cover anything from private equity in Italy post-crisis to currency funds to anything. So I was always a bit attracted by startups and covering the tech scene. I really don't know why, but I'd written about it in Brazil before. I think I saw, it must have been Finovate or maybe the Accenture FinTech Lab. I just read about it and I thought it was really interesting. And at the time, the trading and technology editor was called Michelle Price, and she'd written about it a bit before. So I pitched the story because I was always able to pitch stories to different desks. And I thought, I think this is really interesting. We cover kind of the big players, and this is, I think this is something that in a way or another will be something that we should be covering. And she was like, go for it. So I wrote my first story about fintech, and then I kept going to the events, and then I graduated to one of the desks and I chose to be on the trading and technology one. And then stuff started happening more and more. And then Financial News got a new editor, and he was also keen on us increasing the coverage. And so that just happened. And there was more stuff going on, frankly, after a while. So.
And that was what, last year you started the sort of fintech section, wasn't it?
Yes. We started, which was a monthly, now it's a quarterly, was like a little magazine. And that was September. And then in March or April, I think we launched a separate section on the website, which is just on fintech. I was quite concerned at the beginning. I thought, will we be able to fill this? Yeah, right? Because you can launch it, but then
it's a bit like doing the podcast. I can think of two people to speak to. Who do I speak to then?
Yeah, right.
And now I get about like 8 people a day saying, can I be on your show?
I mean, there's only so many stories about fintech startup challenge winners that you can have on a website that traditionally covers institutional finance. But since then, we've had so much stuff, and there are days where like I can't write everything that's happening, so it's good.
Yes, it's really taking off. I mean, from the sort of super big picture, putting aside this sort of fintech word, which these days kind of annoys me more than it enlightens me, looking at 30 years in financial services in the city, there have been some periods of time when it changes a lot and changes in a very interesting way. I mean, Big Bang being a great example at the start of my career. And then in the 90s, all of the commercial banks, buying and merchant banks and investment banks and the whole kind of thing. And then, of course, in the late noughties, the whole thing blowing up and exploding. And it seems to me that we're in one of those stages now, which is that a lot is changing. The future isn't known. People who say, oh, it's irrelevant, I think will be proven wrong. Fortunately, there are less crazy people going around these days saying, oh, fintech's going to destroy the banks, because they realise that every fintech needs a bank account, which tells you something fairly significant. And your expertise in particular with a firms that you speak to and the financial news's readership is around the existing institutions, or at least you'll come here to talk about that aspect of your knowledge today, the existing institutions and how they're reacting to it. And from my perspective, a bit like you and I perhaps, at first they sort of knew a little bit about it and didn't do very much about it. We're perhaps ahead of the curve compared to the institutions. But by now, the average institution at least needs to have a strategy and has possibly discussed it at the board, even if our strategy is do nothing and wait and see. So how do you see this whole thing as having arisen from the banking side or the financial institution side? And here I'll just use the word banks, meaning all financial institutions.
So as you say, when I started writing about this, there was very much, oh, we're going to destroy the banks. We're like the blockbuster of, no, the banks are like the blockbusters. We're like the Netflix. And I think that's has really changed, at least the attitude. I don't know if everybody's calmed down a bit, or because the banks have started collaborating more, or at least speaking about it more, and then there's less of we're going to kill you sort of attitude. But when I started writing about it, I could track who had said what. Like HSBC has done this, JP Morgan has done that. Now, like, everybody has at least said or done something. Some have done things that are more relevant, or at least seem more significant, while others do smaller things, but it just seems like everyone is talking about it. And as you say, like at a board level, you have the chairman of a bank or the CEO of a bank now bringing up fintech or tech disruption, or just saying we're a technology company now when they speak at conferences. So that's very, very different from a couple of years ago.
Yes, it has changed, hasn't it? The simplistic naivety, I think, is reflected in a comment by Bill Gates a long time ago. It's actually quite a good comment, but it doesn't bear too much close scrutiny, which is that banking is necessary, banks are not. And as I mentioned on the podcast before, that entirely glosses over the fact that money as we know it is bits in bank computers. And so every fintech in the world is just moving or changing bits in one bank's computer and bits in another bank's computer. And until that changes, it's going to be that way. So we are getting much nearer a compete cooperate perspective. And I think that my view on the fintech is that it really means two very different types of thing. It means the new financial services providers, such as Zopa or Market Invoice, who are providing financial services to consumers or to businesses in a new and fresh way. It also means a completely different thing, which you might call new IT companies, which are companies who've created or been more innovative than sort of big slow-moving hulks, and they've got a new piece of software they want to sell to a bank. And as a result of this, I think that sort of the banks have spent some time trying to work out what it was in the first place. And in talking to you before, you were talking to me that you basically see four main ways that banks are approaching this. The first is the fund strategy. The second is the innovation department. I have some views on innovation departments.
Everyone has views.
Everyone's got views on innovation departments.
Maybe they have views on it themselves.
Exactly, yes, yes, exactly. And the third is the accelerator strategy. And then the fourth is the compete strategy. So going through those in turn, the funds, as you say, the funds seem to be all over the place. I mean, what are a few banks that have got funds and what are they doing with them as far as you can see?
So banks have always had these arms that invest in young companies for strategic reasons. But over the past few years, they've made these arms, or they've launched new separate funds, kind of like corporate venture arms, and have made it a lot more, at least they publicized it more. Whereas the principal strategic investment team, since they were strategic, they were a bit secretive. Now they've sort of launched these big funds, and the goal is, they say, both to kind of invest in companies that might be relevant for them in the future, that they might partner with, and also to make some money. So obviously it's quite hard because you have to pick both a company that works for you at the moment, but also one that will be a winner. So banks that have funds include Citi Ventures, which is based in the US, HSBC has a 200 million fund, Santander has a 100 million fund, CME Group also has a strategic investments team, BBVA, kind of everyone has one now. And they've kind of been sort of working at different varying degrees of speed, and they've all taken a different approach.
In the earliest days of the funds, I mean, someone whose views I listened to had said to me about one of the bank's funds that actually it was just kind of PR and spin and hype, and so be that as it may. But when you mention these numbers, which end up being quite big numbers, and you add them all up and you get to a billion, Then I start wondering, what on earth would you spend it on? You know, let's say someone gives me a job tomorrow, like, here's £1 billion, Mike, you know something about fintech, go and spend it.
Well, valuations are very high, so they'll run out of money very quickly.
Valuations are very high, but I mean, if you look at even Funding Circle, who have probably raised more money than anybody else in London, their last E round was £150 million, $1,000. And you know, that's the biggest ticket item, even if you've taken the whole lot, which you probably couldn't. And otherwise, if you look at Market Invoice, the leaders in invoice financing, they've done $500 million. I can't remember off the top of my head, they raised something like $15 million last time around. So for me, certainly on the new financial services providers side of the equation, the Zopas, the rate setters, all those kind of people, I don't think you can actually spend very much. You know, you've then got the kind of all the sort of startup-y world, which we were covering in the last podcast before this one. And again, you can chuck all sorts of money at startups. And as we know, 90% plus of the startups will disappear, which then sort of leaves me a little bit thinking it's what I think of as in terms of the sort of new IT companies, which is people who've got new stuff or blockchain. But where do you think the money's going? Or is it just kind of somebody's been given a sort of expense account and say, oh, you can spend $100 million if you can spend it kind of stuff?
So I think it depends. Some of them have funds that are earmarked, which means you're just doing it off the balance sheet, while others have actually separate kind of entities. And some, as I said, have been investing more than others. And I guess it just depends on how big the organization is, how they've managed to structure it so that they're separate and so they don't have to go to compliance 150 times before they get approved. And that's quite important. I remember when some of these UK-based ones launched, I heard the most skeptical people about them were the VCs. Obviously, I don't know if they saw it as competition or maybe they thought, well, that's our job. Like, they surely a banker can do the same.
I'm sure for both reasons, one of which that the VCs would think, oh, we do that better. What do they know? But the second of which is I am sure that VCs go, hang on, you can't spend $1 billion in this market at the moment.
Yeah, I think what they brought up was, why would a company want money from a bank? Which I think I'm always torn with this, right? Because obviously, if you're some sort of company that has services of banks and the bank, then obviously you might want money from a bank, right? Because then you get a client. But then you might end up alienating other clients, because why would, I don't know, like Barclays want to work with an HSBC-backed companies? The attitude is changing, but I guess the sector is still very competitive.
So it's a good time to move on to what I listed as a third, but we can take it as a second, which is the FinTech Accelerator strategy. So we've got, you know, Barclays Accelerator, and now more generally in tech. There is a view, of course, that if you're in a tech accelerator owned by any firm, whether it's IBM or Barclays, there's a good side and a bad side to that. I mean, the good side is if you get on with that firm and you really like them and all that kind of stuff and you like what they've got and you like Ping It in the case of Barclays sort of mobile money, you're fine. But if you don't particularly get on with that one, you don't like Ping It, and most people don't from what I've heard, then you might get rejected from accelerator not having done anything with a bank who does it, and then somehow there's a bit of a taint over you.
Yeah.
It's a bit like you go to the Telegraph tomorrow and you don't end up writing any fintech articles.
I think it's lighter than that. Like, for example, if you get an investment from a company, from a fund, then you're somewhat marked as the company that got money from them. Unless it's a later stage of investment. So if you're like a Series E and you get money from General Atlantic and JP Morgan, then that's fine because it's like a different type of level. But if you're like a 2-year-old company and you're raising $4 million from a bank, then they're quite involved with you closely, right? Which has advantages and disadvantages. But the accelerator, I think it can be helpful because you get connections. But then, as you say, if all the mentors are from one bank and you don't get along with them and they don't want to work with you, then like, what's the point? But why would they have chose you unless you got along? But there are accelerators that bring together lots of banks, and that's quite interesting because you wouldn't generally think that banks collaborate a lot on stuff that's strategic, right? Because to some extent, some stuff will be of a competitive advantage, while other stuff like back office, compliance, that doesn't give you any advantage. So it makes sense to collaborate. So maybe those ones might be more helpful if you're not really sure you want to sell to, or you want to get a variety of views from different institutions.
Yes, I think it's a sign that the whole sector's maturing, and that if you go back 18 months, perhaps, you know, the general view would be, hey, incubators are wonderful, accelerators are wonderful, it's all great. And Alexander Gaillard of InvestGlass was talking 2 weeks ago before this podcast about the pros and cons of incubators and accelerators from a fintech startup's perspective. And the answer is that sometimes they're useful and sometimes they're not. And there's no alternative other than thinking about yourself in your particular situation. I mean, Barclays is obviously the one that's been around the longest. Citigroup keep going in about their Citigroup FinTech Challenge.
Their mobile challenge.
Yeah. Is that a kind of accelerator or is that just a competition?
That's a competition, but that's more focused. Well, at least from what I've seen, lots of the companies there are quite retail, whereas UBS has one now. And I went to their challenge in London. I was quite surprised because many of the companies had a kind of institutional focus and investment banking, which was what they're going for. So I think, and again, I don't know how useful startup challenges are. Definitely, it puts you in front of people. And that's always helpful, but you have to evaluate whether you want to spend like 3 months somewhere and do that and at what stage you are. I guess if you already have good connections, because maybe you came from the industry, it's less helpful.
I spoke to the main board of a French bank much earlier in the year, and they wanted to know whether it was sort of compete or collaborate, whether they should sort of panic or ignore it, basically, and this kind of thing. And I said the problem wasn't so much the fintechs in the short term. The problem was, if you want to do something with fintechs, and you put an ad in the paper, we're a huge bank, we've got loads of money, please come and see me. It's a bit like a sort of an 18-year-old girl saying, hey, I need a boyfriend, put an ad in the newspaper. You'll get lots of queries, you get lots of people coming in, but if you've got 100 boys lined up outside your door when you're 17-year-old, yeah, it's really very difficult. And the same thing for a bank. If you're a huge bank, you put these challenges out there, oh, we want people to come, then you know, you can just end up being swamped with stuff, and you've got a huge filtering process to go through then to find out the good ones.
But I think what I failed to mention, and applies to all these initiatives, is that people at banks are busy, right? Like, they have other stuff to do, especially regulation, dealing with regulation and all the rest. So all of these initiatives, in a way, like, help the startups get to the right people. It focuses the initiative a bit. You don't really have the headspace, I guess, if you're the head of, I don't know, FX and rates, to go around and check all the startups. Whereas with these initiatives, you at least have, like, say, a day where you're, like, speaking to the companies, and you might end up speaking to someone. They'd send you an email. You don't have time to read it. So at least there's an advantage there. And the startups get to kind of speak to the right people, or at least they get a way in.
So it's a dating process.
Yeah, right? It's like they get a way in.
Yes. So, I mean, one way of looking at that, I mean, we didn't have a section for the sort of kind of competitions, but maybe that's a fifth approach that we're seeing. But reframing that, you could see that as a kind of open innovation, which is that we're a huge bank, we've got great distribution, we've got huge sums of money, we've got a gazillion clients, but you know what? We're actually not very good at coming up with sort of fresh, bright ideas by half a dozen people, so let's try and get a few in and let's filter them, which then brings us on to internal innovation departments. So what do you think about those then? And don't lose all your circulation amongst innovation departments, and I'll be rude if you want to.
I'm a journalist, right? I'm impartial, so I can't say. So I think there have always been innovation departments.
Have they?
So I think so, right? But maybe they didn't call them innovation departments. I'm not sure. Well,
forget financial services for the moment. Sort of zooming out to the big picture, there's two views of innovation departments as far as I can see. One of which says, when you see a company setting up an innovation department, sell its shares. And the other, which is that innovation departments help people focus in a time of change, yada, yada, yada. And again, I think it depends. The argument for when you see a bank set up an innovation department or sell its shares comes from the fact that, going back to when I started in the city, Commonwealth Benson, being the merchant bank, sort of lived on its wits for 200 years. And basically they wanted people who felt that their day job was to keep changing and keep up with what was going on and respond to the world and that kind of stuff.
I think the main issue is, I mean, shouldn't you be innovative anyhow?
Yeah, exactly, that's what I mean. It's like, let's say the Financial News sets up an innovation department tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's their job to keep up with all the new stuff. But hang on, you're supposed to be a coal miner. You're supposed to be the coal face digging.
There is one thing I think that's helpful. If you're a giant organization, then everybody might be doing innovative things, but at a different kind of, on a different pace.
Yes.
And so you probably need someone at the top, in a way, or someone who kind of sets the agenda from a very broad perspective and then filters down the kind of message to be innovative, but with a little bit of direction. So we think of this about big data. So you and your, I don't know, in the trading floor, you should do something about it, and then the other person in the back office. But at least we're on the same
page. It's a bit like joined up government.
Yeah.
Rather than each department in the civil service having its own digital strategy, the government now has a digital strategy thing which is supposed to cover it all. You know, so there's uniform standards of, I don't know, websites or emails or, you know, all that.
That's the thing. But to me, I guess, I mean, should you really have a CTO now who's not also the chief of innovation? I mean, your CTO should kind of be innovative, or else that's probably an issue, right? But then again, I think it's just politics and the way an organization is structured, and then, like, does the CTO who's there, maybe he's not really innovative, but you don't want to kick him out. I don't know.
Well, my experience is that given the size of the big banks, which is vast, inconceivably vast, unless you actually worked inside them, that if you're the CXO of anything, CEO, CIO, CTO, C whatever you want, you're just 1,000 levels above the coalface, you know? And the job is purely resources and politics and organisation, and you're managing people who are managing people who are managing people who are managing people. So it can be almost a kind of a bureaucracy role at that stage, rather than somebody who's playing with some new exciting app on the side. So there are pros and cons to innovation departments, as we discussed. One of the ones that a podcaster heard recently in the States, actually on a blockchain, this chap was saying that his experience was that he has to engage the CEO. Now, everyone always wants to engage the CEO of organizations, because if you've got his buy-in, it tends to make things happen. He said, where they've engaged the CEO on their blockchain ideas, it has worked, they've got good business going. He said, where we've engaged the innovation department, we've ended up wasting time.
I think for all of these initiatives, and I think they're more you could be having all of these four within the same bank. So what really matters is to determine who they report to, right? Because if they've got a backing of someone really important at a management level, or if they've got the support of the business, then it's probably more likely that their work will end up in a result.
Yeah, that's a good summary. You just ruined the whole podcast, because that's the answer to the podcast, which I better remember to the end, which is that it doesn't actually matter which strategy you've got. In a sense, it's how well you execute it that actually matters. You know, we're not sort of sitting here, either of us saying, oh, I think strategy three is best and four is worst.
Because they're all a mix, right? Some organizations have a venture fund, they have accelerators, and also another of these kind of ways of doing things that I've noticed is just competing directly. Right? So some banks might be doing all three.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the compete as a good example. Goldman's has been trying to position itself as a P2P and all that, which seems to be complete BS.
They haven't started yet, though.
They haven't started, but also they're just doing direct lending. It's not P2P anything.
No, but they never said that they were going to do P2P.
Obviously, it wasn't in the financial news. It must have been something else. But
online lending, right? Right, yeah. So the idea is they take the technology aspect of P2P in a sense, but they do their own lending, because they certainly have the balance sheet. And the idea is you can now do it much more cheaply, because you can just use technology and analyze the data. And if you have the advantage of having the balance sheet, then that's easier. The other hand is, how are you going to originate the loans, right? Because people might not naturally think to go to Goldman Sachs for consumer loan, because that's not what they've been doing traditionally. But I'm quite curious to see how that will evolve, right? Because that kind of shows, what if banks decide to react? Because for now, a lot of it has been sort of borderline innovator's dilemma, you know, and I hate to bring it up because everybody brings the innovator's dilemma up. But we've seen them, some of them have launched accelerators, other things, but most of them haven't said, okay, we're going to integrate this product, we're going to launch this product that competes directly with one of the disruptors. And now we're starting to see it, and BlackRock again bought a robot advisor. So it's interesting to see if they start, and then they certainly already have the advantage of a big distribution, will they be able to kind of stop what's happening or not? And maybe this is the year where we'll see more of this sort of direct competition happening, or the companies collaborating with startups and launching services.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, just thinking, sort of, you know, getting lost a bit in my own mind here in all the detail of funds and innovation departments and accelerators and competing in competitions and all that kind of thing. I'm just thinking about, you know, if we zoom up to the biggest level, you know, the interweb came around in the 1990s, and it's pretty amazing how many decades it's actually taken for the interweb to feed through into strategic change in industries. I mean, another example clearly is the media. So it took the better part of 20 years for the interweb to start affecting the media industry.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got a variety of responses. So Dow Jones is part of News International. They've got a paywall. Something like the Telegraph we mentioned, it's got what I call a soft paywall, which is, once I've read half a dozen articles, it says, bugger off, you've read six for free, you can register or subscribe to get more. And then there were ones like The Guardian, whose competitive response has been to have no paywall and really focus on having a lot of sort of digital stuff out there and all that kind of stuff. Now, again, it's a bit like, how are banks responding? Who knows which of those things are going to be right? And actually, in a sense, it's not so much about the strategy, but it's actually what's the thinking behind it and where's your business going as an organization, yada, yada, yada. And I think the same thing with financial services, and in financial services case, obviously accelerated by the sort of 2008 crisis / disaster, which is that it's basically taken the better part of 20 years for the interweb to hit financial services. And what's the response of financial services to that? And this train of thought was launched by, you mentioning Goldman's trying to be sort of client-focused and all that, using the interweb, because actually that's kind of what it's about. So forgetting all the fintechy stuff, you've just got these vast conglomerates, which are a nightmare to manage, if not impossible, and you've got small startups with half a dozen people in the room who really care about their clients and don't have any of the stuff getting in the way. So were it not for regulation, perhaps some of these smaller startups would take on the big banks more. So what do you think has really changed then, Anna, in recent years? We're talking about what's actually happening. I mean, where do you think we are now? How far through this change process are we in media or in financial services?
Well, I leave media aside. But for financial services, I think it's just the beginning. Sometimes I wonder, is this all a hype? I have to wonder, right?
Because
that's my
job.
That's my job. I'm not like the cheerleader, so I have to think, is this a hype? But then rationally, I think, will people start going back to sending money with the post, right? You know, probably not. So something's going to happen. And this is just the beginning, because we haven't really seen the fintech sort of competition really like hurting the bottom line of banks yet. Will that happen? I don't know. But definitely what's happening now is really a change in attitude. I mean, I was at Cybos last year, and InnoTribe has for years been talking about all this fintech disruption and technology. They were always like in a side corner. And this year, the rooms of their discussions were always packed. And not only were there like panels about fintech, which is what they do. But on the main stage, everywhere, you'd hear, even at the compliance forum, you'd hear people talking about fintech. So at least it's brought the awareness that digital is happening, and in some way you need to listen to what's happening and devise a strategy. Whether they'll actually succeed or whether this might just disappear, so remains to be seen, I guess.
Yes, I think going back to sort of cheerleading of that, I think one of the great strengths of your coverage in particular is that you're not, as I mentioned at the outset, I've never regarded you as one of the fluffy bunnies who are just sort of cheerleaders with sort of pom-poms and short skirts and go, rah, 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 how wonderful it all is. You know, there have been quite a few of those people around in fintech over the last year, and it's interesting to see a lot of them quietly disappearing, surrounded by press releases saying what a wonderful job they've done. People who had no background in finance or no background in technology, busily talking about fintech. And in terms of your stuff, I know from a large number of people you've spoken to that you do adopt the best journalistic standards, which is being critical and questioning people. And, you know, is this true? Rather than, you know, it's all wonderful. And as you say, we'll see how it goes. But as you also say, digital ain't going away. The interweb isn't going away. You know, what financial services look like in 5 years' time is up for grabs, which is why it's very interesting at the moment. Before we move on, just to telling us a little bit about the sort of fintech coverage of the financial news and where you're going there, you were talking before to me about this war for talent.
I think this is one of the major aspects of what's happening.
In media, obviously, I've heard that fintech's journalist salary is getting bid up hugely.
Oh, yeah, crazy. Yeah, can't control it. I'm like saying, no, stop, please. But yeah, in finance, you can see some of the banks paying more attention to how they kind of market their tech positions. Because obviously, even if you devise a really good strategy, if you're still losing all your top technology talent to Google and Facebook and to any other like big company that has like the need for technologists, which is every company now, then you might not be able to execute on that strategy. So I think it's really critical. I think the fintech component is also critical because by showing you're doing innovative stuff, you kind of also show to potential candidates that, wait, we're an interesting company, you want to work for us, not necessarily for Google. Because I don't know how many top technologists would go for Goldman over Google at this point, whereas maybe years ago, Goldman was the best option you could have. But now, like people, especially my generation, they value like quality of life more and the salaries have gotten very similar. And so I think that's really tough. And some of the banks do openly acknowledge it, and they're launching programs to try to train their own people and make sure they still have the really good technologies they need because their systems are critical.
Yes. I'm glad you raised this soft side of it rather than, you know, do we have an accelerator or do we have a fund? Let's get some consultants in to advise us on one or the other. Because as you say, there were some sort of cultural things around the war for talent. I mean, from my perspective, one of the things that went wrong in the UK economy was far too much talent went into banking. Banking and finance, from my perspective, is the oil in the engine. It became the engine in its own right, which was a bloody disaster. So I'm quite glad to see talent and people leaving universities or MBA courses or whatever going into different parts of the economy because it makes it more of a balanced economy. Having said that, finance ain't going away and needs to keep improving. So we'll see where that goes. Now, talking of keeping improving, I was about to say, like me, you're a journalist, but actually you're a proper journalist. I'm not really a journalist at all.
You're a citizen journalist.
I'm a people's journalist. I'm one of the people. And I've got slightly less pressure than you, but every 2 weeks I have to find something new to say and someone new to interview. But you have to do that sort of constantly. And while you're doing this constant sort of articles out all the time, you've also got to try and think strategically about where the whole sort of fintech coverage is going rather than just writing 1,000 articles a month or whatever.
So,
it is.
I'm not really the strategy behind all of this, but Financial News traditionally covers the City of London and the financial industry, right? So whether this is going to actually impact it forever or not, it's something that's happening now. So we thought it would make sense for our readers to read about it. And now they actually do want to read about it, especially some topics more than others. And then who knows, maybe some of these companies might become the financial giants of the future. And so since we are kind of read by everyone at all the major banks, then it might make sense to kind of be writing about people that might become the future leaders. But, you know, you never know. But at this point, there's just interesting stuff happening. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, as I said at the outset, you're the only full-time journalist I know covering. And the FT has people who cover it a little bit. We didn't get time to argue about blockchain, which is probably a bit of a relief for both of us. But the FT has done quite a good job being sarcastic about Bitcoin, which quite amused me. But otherwise, there isn't the coverage that there needs to be. Talking of old journalists, I was talking to Brian Basham recently, who was the chairman of Archover, amongst other things, as well as founding the Broad Street Communications Group. And he was telling me that he started as a journalist in the 1970s covering unit trusts. probably a bit like yourself, you know, a young journalist starting out in somewhere, being given the photocopying and making the tea at the beginning and all that kind of stuff. And he was saying about how difficult it was to persuade newspapers at the time that unit trusts were going to be a big thing of the future. You know, you go, oh, no, of course they're not. Now, of course, you know, there's huge amounts of money in unit trusts and they haven't gone away. And I think the same thing about fintech. And I think it's to the credit of not just yourself, but the financial news as a whole, that you are devoting significant resources to this area. We don't know what's going to happen. But as you say, financial services, like every other industry in the world, can't ignore digital. Digital isn't going away. So I think you're really to be praised for what you're doing in raising awareness.
It is quite hard, I guess, at the beginning, if you traditionally cover deals that are like 3 billion and up, to say, why are we writing about a 500,000 or 1 million fundraising by a company nobody's ever heard of. So that makes you have to kind of change your perspective. But now the noise is so loud that it just seems like it makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, time's gone by, and I recommend everyone to read Anna's coverage in the Financial News and these regular periodicals that come out. One of the most challenging things I find is actually working out what's going on in fintech, largely because there's so much puff and hype and bullshit and LinkedIn so-called thought leader arguments around, most of which are rubbish. So it's really quite hard to get nuggets of fact and interest, and I very much recommend your direction as one of them. So thanks for being on the show today, Anna.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.